What's up, everybody? In today's episode, we dive quickly into the DFW real estate market statistics, days on market, average price, that sort of thing. We touch on all of those types of things so you can kind of get a feel for how things are moving year over year. Then we get into the news where Tavis talks about something that is near and dear to his heart, the White Rock Home Tour. He's been a part of that. He's been a sponsor. Super cool event. And we also talk about a report that's showing that the rental rates in DFW are moving. In some areas, they're up. In some areas, they're down. And then we also talk about how a federal economist is laying out how he thinks the commission structure should be for realtors moving forward as all these lawsuits are getting settled and things are everyone's tinkering with the real estate and realtor market moving forward. So we talk about that. And then we get into a great conversation kind of focused on newbies. I'm dealing with a lot of new investors and having a lot of conversations about the factors that you're taking into account. And Tavis weighs in on the advice he gives to newer investors. We talk about some of the options that you have if you're just getting started out. And at the end of the day, we just want people to get started. And so we kind of talk about that, how we would go about it, our journey was. So there you go. There you have it. You can hop around a little bit. If you have not yet, please like, subscribe, copy this thing, send it to a friend, tell them you just wouldn't even believe these two guys in DFW are talking about real estate in such a coherent and friendly manner. And we would love you forever. And until next Tuesday, where we have an interview coming up, so please watch for that. I just wish someone would ring that bell. You don't have to go to a mall. You can buy tickets at each of the houses. You don't have to start any one spot. You just find one of the houses, go there, park. You get your ticket, you get your stamp, whatever it is, and then you can use that for the rest of the homes.
He's vetted his exit strategies. And I think that's a part that if you're going to analyze anything, analyze your exit strategies. If you get into the deal and you don't want it anymore or it doesn't make sense, how do you get out of it?
You are now listening to the Real Estate Heavyweights Podcast.
You see this guy here staring back at you? That's your toughest opponent. Every time you get into the ring, that's who you're going against. I believe that in boxing, and I do believe that in life.
Your weekly deep dive into DFW real estate, life, and beyond. With your hosts, Tavis Westbrook and Ashton Hines.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of the Real Estate Heavyweights Podcast. I'm Ashton Hines and I'm here with my good friend and real estate mentor, Tavis Westbrook. If you don't know me, I'm the newbie of the group. I've flipped four houses. I have one long-term hold over in Sweetwater and I'm actually questioning maybe trying to get rid of that. I may not even be a long-term hold guy for too long because I'm just trying to debate on where I want to be with that and maybe deploy that money somewhere else. But either way, I'm early on my decisions and learning all the ropes. And one of the guys that is actively every day, you know, coaching me and saying, maybe don't do that. He's helped me out in a lot of ways. He sent contractors to help me out, bailed me out of a couple flips that were going sideways. But then since then, has just been an awesome friend and has great insight into the real estate area. It's Tavis, and he's here with us. What's up, Tavis? Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, brother. Well, and that's a great intro. And, you know, we've said it again, so I'm going to say it one more time. You need to raise the rents. That was the whole idea of buying that property in Sweetwater.
Well, Brandy,
had room to tell her the rents were going up $100 a month. And I think
I know, but she's struggling with it as it is now. And, problem. So here's, you know, we're going to drop a nugget really early on in this episode, but here's one of the problems of investing in a fairly rural area. You know, Sweetwater's near Abilene. Abilene's a great market, but Sweetwater's about 30 minutes away. On paper, it's a great, great purchase. You know, I think that purchase price was around $67,000. Her rent was $700 or $750. And we were going to raise it to about $850. And so I actually financed it. And so I have some private lenders that I'm paying $700 a month to get, basically pay the mortgage. You know, she pays the mortgage on my lender. And I was going to refinance it. Well, then the rates went up and I couldn't burr out of it. And so I'm just kind of floating. I'm not really making much. I might be even losing a little bit after all the insurance and all the taxes. And just it's kind of floating there. So we were going to raise the rents. Well, then she gets behind, and the job market there is not amazing, you know? And so, and her skill level is not, I guess, very high. And so there's only a handful of jobs that she can do. And whenever one of those goes away, it's like, well, you know, what do you do? But the problem is she's lived in this house 30 something years. She grew up there, and from the sentimental side, it's like, man, I can't pull the rug on her. I really need mm-hmm. to try to help figure this out. But on the business side, you're like, Tavis had nothing to do with this house, because I bought this house from Tavis, and this is kind of a distant family member of Tavis's. If I was just looking at this and objectively from a piece of paper, like, would I go back into it? And the answer is probably not right now. So just trying to figure out going forward, like balancing the sentimental part, trying to do the right thing as a person, but knowing business wise, like I have some investors whose money's kind of, you know, tied up that they kind of want to deploy some places. I mean, it's good for them, but you know, they kind of want to use it in some other places. And so I may run over there. All that to be said is this 3 weeks I've got off right now, I may run over to Sweetwater and talk with Brandy. And, you know, I've actually never seen the house, and I only seen pictures, and I kind of just want to get a feel for it. And, you know, maybe talk to an agent over there and say, what would you think this would even go for? So I don't know. We'll revisit mm-hmm. that, but you got to be cautious about investment deals that are outside of your scope of, you know, like daily, you know, path, because I think some people do really well investing from a distance, and then sometimes it's just tough. And I, you know, if she had been on top of it and we could raise the rent to 850, like I'd be killing it. It'd be great.
So what you're telling the audience is I sold you a bad deal.
No, you sold me a good deal. And at the time that it penciled, because we were going to burr out of it, you know, and we were going to raise the rents, and then I was going to refinance to a long term, and I was going to be able to cash flow like $200 a month. And you actually sold it to me for under market value. So there was already equity in the deal, you know? So it looked great.
She's one of those people that I think if you, and I don't think she does it maliciously, but if you give her an inch, she'll take a mile. And so you have to be very, not harsh, but just very strict on what your guidelines are. And that was how I was with her. And I mean, because when I bought it, she used to not, you know, I bought it, it was a tax foreclosure, or it was going into tax foreclosure. I saved it from that, bought the deal, and then she'd never paid rent before, right? Like they hadn't paid taxes on that thing in 10 years or something. That's why I was in trouble. And so when I bought it, I started her off at like, I don't know, $500 a month or $550, and she wasn't used to paying rent, you know? So it was a stair step, but I mean, it was like, we're going to start there. These are the guidelines. Yeah. This is how you pay. And I think she paid me every 2 weeks to make it easy on her. And then we, you know, each year I'm like, hey, I'm having to bring you up. And then COVID hit. And I didn't raise it during COVID. Is I was like, okay, you know, and then after COVID, then I was like, hey, I got to raise you up again. So I finally got it to 750, you know, and then that's where I sold it to you at basically like the 1% rule, you know?
Yeah. No, it worked out, and there was equity in the deal. I think we had kind of comped the house, and it was actually over 100. And so whenever I was going to go to refinance it, it was all going to work out great, you know?
Yeah.
So
the issue is, you know, again, it goes back to, you know, when you're trying to do the right thing with somebody living in a home that has sentimental value, there's always a risk, you know, because that was why I was very specific on who I could sell it to. Cause I needed to sell it to somebody, you know, like you, that I could have a conversation with that would not just kick her out. Right. Because the highest and best use for the house technically is a flip, you know, based on what the value could be and getting in there and renovating it and selling it. You know, that's kind of one of the highest and best use. Or you renovate it and then you lease it for higher rates, because the rents, you know, some of those homes over there were going for $1,300 to $1,400 a month. Renovated and updated, you know, so you had a lot of room. There was a lot of possibilities, but you know, when you're working with somebody like that, that's not willing to really change their lifestyle, you know, to, you know, cause I told her several times, I was like, hey, why don't you just commute to Abilene and like get a job in Abilene and commute, and you'll make more money. Like, to me, that logically makes sense, but you know, somebody that's growing up there just not ever willing to change what they're doing. So,
yeah, So all that to be said is I do own a long-term rental and I'm learning lessons, but like a lot of my early lessons, it may not be something that you want to emulate. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later. Our real estate conversation on the backside of this podcast is going to be sort of geared more towards the new investor, all the options you're looking at, some of the things you want to consider. So I've been there. And like I said, luckily, Tavis has kind of been there to kind of guide me through, hey, think about this, think about that. And, you know, overall, it's worked out. Luckily, you know, do something like this and try it and you're not losing your shirt. You're just learning lessons. And that's the best kind. You know, of course, you'd love to come out on the other side and make so much money. You can sell a course for, you know, $4,000 a weekend to teach people how to do exactly what you just did. And it's like, nah, probably won't do that. But I did, you know, I am learning lessons and kind of figuring out my lane and sort of my core genius of certain things that I'm good at and all that stuff. Well, why don't we get into a little bit of market update? Market in DFW year over year from this time in 2023 is still relatively flat, except for days on market. A year ago, days on market were low, and some counties were almost 100% higher. So days on market are creeping up to, you know, the 30s and 35s, and it was super hot there for a while. You know, we're having to watch. You know, we talked to our friend Rob a couple weeks ago, who had an offer that had fallen through. I need to check in, but the other day I texted him, he had two offers and they were going to execute on one of them. So this point, hopefully they're through the option period. I really hope they are, but I think they had been 23 days on the market. So they were still really healthy. And I asked him if he was going to still do okay and make some money. And he said, yeah. So that's awesome. They were patient. Hopefully they didn't have to give in too much and they're not having to just do a ton of work in the option period, but you're still under 30 days. I think they're still have a really strong, you know, position to not have to just give in all of this stuff. And so according to him, he's doing well. So that goes with the narrative of, look, you know, under 35 days is normal. About around 11 or 12 showings per pending is normal across the MLS right now. People are having to discount slightly, around 3% across the MLS. So that's been similar for the last couple months. The thing that is going up is days on market. And the other thing is inventory is creeping up a little bit. And I think a lot of it has to do with there's just not a lot of movement. We've talked about this. Rates are still high. We just checked the rates, depending on who you're checking out. High sixes, mid sevens is the average. For a 30-year fixed, FHA is lower. And so there's just still a lot of people sitting on the sidelines. And I think a lot of the news is, hey, Fed's going to drop the rate soon. Fed's going to drop the rate soon. They're going to drop it 3 times this year. They're going to drop it. And so I think there's just a lot of people kind of like waiting to jump in. They don't want to make a mistake. But heaven forbid that first weekend that the rate drops, it might go bananas. Like if you have a house on the market, if we could get a house that's going to flip and just sit on it for a second and like, okay, here, let's wait for the first drop and then go for it and see what happens. I think that could be really cool. So, all right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the news.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
From Dallas, Texas, the Flash, apparently official.
There's good news and bad news.
This is a massive story. Who wouldn't publish it?
We landed on the moon!
Man, I've got certain information, all right? Certain things have come to light.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
So, Tavis, why don't you, a little bit of local news in Dallas. This is a cool event. I went to this last year, and you've been really involved in this event. Why don't you talk about the White Rock Tour of Homes that's coming up?
Yeah, so the White Rock Home Tour is an event that's put on to support a local elementary school. And this is the 16th year anniversary of this White Rock Home Tour. We were fortunate enough to get involved back in 2018, I believe. After, so I built a couple homes over there near White Rock Lake in between like 2016 and 2018, I believe. And nevertheless, one of actually a couple of houses got voted in to be on the tour. And then you have to get the homeowner's approval, obviously, to do it. So one of them ended up going on 86-26 Deisman was on the home tour back in 2018. And since then, they've reached out to me, year over year to kind of, see if I want to be a sponsor or be involved again. And then COVID happened. And so COVID happened and things kind of shut down for a while. They didn't do it. And then it picked back up. I want to say last year maybe was the first year back after the COVID hiatus. So nevertheless, it supports Hexter Elementary School, which is a Dallas ISD school. But, this is a great event. It's really cool. You can find it on... they have it on Instagram, they have it on Facebook, and then, of course, their website is White Rock Home Tour 2024.
And we'll link that in the show notes, and then we'll put it out on social. We'll just make sure everyone can find that.
Yeah. So they have kind of a mixture of homes that go on the tour every year. Some, a lot of times, it's a lot of mid-century modern architecture. Sometimes it's just mid-century homes, it doesn't necessarily, it could be a mid-century ranch, and then they have modern homes as well. And basically their committee gets together and narrows it down what homes they're going to put on the tour each year, and every year it's a little different. But it's a great show, if you will. It's going to be this year April 20th and 21st, so the 20th and the 21st, Saturday and Sunday of 2024. And they're all pretty close together. And basically, you can get online and purchase tickets. I think they're $20. Let me verify that real quick. But it's pretty easy. And you just basically drive house to house and put on your booties. Oh, they're $25 a ticket. So it's a great event. If you guys like architecture, want to get different ideas and just see what's going on, what new trends are and things like that. I believe, Ashton, that your first year to go was last year. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I went last year. It was awesome. And last year was more of a, they didn't really have any of the modern ones. I think there's 7 or 8 homes, maybe. You don't have to go to a mall. You can buy tickets at each of the houses. You don't have to start any one spot. You just find one of the houses, go there, park. You get your ticket, you get your stamp, whatever it is. And then you can use that for the rest of the homes. But last year, there was some really cool time capsule type houses where they were obviously really well done and clean and all that, but they hadn't really changed a whole lot. If they had renovated anything, they had done everything they could do to keep it very true to the time period. Then they had a couple that were hybrids where they were mid-century moderns, but they had done a great update, more of a current layout, current family feel with, TV rooms and stuff like that. And I don't even know the address, but there was one last year that was just phenomenal, just really, really well done, current home, and but had a great vibe. One part of the mid-century feel is like the big windows and a lot of cool grown landscaping. And so that part of town has been there forever. And so that's one thing is that part of town, you get to experience the mature trees and all the landscaping that up here, Frisco, McKinney, Prosper, all that stuff is just a lot of neighborhoods just still don't have that yet. And last year there was actually a church on there, the Episcopal Church, was on the tour. And so they had some interesting things. So I will definitely do it again. I think it'd be a fun kind of social event, everybody take the tour and go meet up afterwards and kind of talk about it. And if you have a chance to go down into the White Rock area, if you've never spent time down there, this is a great way to get an experience with that neighborhood and see the beauty of the White Rock Lake. So yeah, for sure a worthwhile event. So we will link that in our show notes for show. So in other news, we've touched on the ongoing lawsuits against NAR and Keller Williams and Berkshire Hathaway and this and that. Well, this week, one thing that has not happened in some of these settlements with the big brokerages is there hasn't really been a plan to say, okay, how's this going to be necessarily different outside of, hey, we're going to change our training. We're going to be, make buyers and sellers more aware of, that the commissions can be negotiable and all this. Well, an executive economist at one of the the Federal Reserve banks. I don't know how it all works, but some government office somewhere, there was an economist that did a study, and they kind of laid out a what they would say would be a plan moving forward, an actionable plan. And a lot of it is looking at the European model of real estate, where the overall percentage of commissions based on the transaction is much lower. And what it comes down to is they think that it'll be more of a, on the buy side, more of an a la carte menu that will start become more prevalent. And so you might hire a buy side real estate agent. You might, you know, we were talking about earlier, Tavis and I, you can hire an attorney. You know, hey, I've got the search down. I just need someone to help me out with the contracts. Can you look over this for me? You may just hire someone to go, hey, I just need you to get me in some houses, show me around. I'll pay you this much money to show me around. And then, of course, you're going to have the full service people that says, look, I can do all this, and this is my commission, and this is what you're going to pay me up front. So it does seem that it's changing, you know, quickly in one way, slowly, because there's these little tidbits coming out. But when the government, this one government agency comes out, I think some of these lawsuits are going to start having some action plans involved. And I think, you know, it will be based somewhat on this because they're actually looking at the European model, and evidently it's a lot. And in their mind, so I think they say there's about $100 billion, billion with a B, of commissions paid in the real estate transactions in the United States a year. They think this will cut that down by about $30 billion. And a lot of that will be on the buy side, I would imagine. So maybe on some on the sell side. So yeah, we'll see. The transition might be messy. Tavis had an experience or heard of an agent that had an experience recently with a seller that had all sorts of opinions on how it should go. And I think it'll be a lot of friction and a lot of learning. And but it'll take a while, and I think it'll shake out. And hopefully at the end of the day, you know, agents that are doing a good job and worth their weight and the knowledge that they bring and experience will get paid, you know. So,
yeah. Well, and our office, you know, both Ash and I are associated with Keller Williams Dallas Preston Road, which is part of the KW Go network, which is basically kind of our region made up of multiple offices that have ownership kind of branched between them. So our legal compliance team has kind of got together with attorneys, and they put together a new exclusive client representation agreement. And it's very spelled out and very detailed. In fact, I'm looking at it now, and I sent it to you, Ashton, as well. And it's about, you know, it's a 3-page document, and it kind of goes into it. It just very specifically lays out agreements and understandings, and then kind of the structure of how something's going to be done. Even representation for representing tenants, you know, for a residential lease and things like that in there. So it just really gets into detail and spells it out. I think that way that there's no confusion. And this is, you know, an agreement that you're going to have representing a buyer from the beginning. I think that over the years, the buyer's representation has been very loosely implemented, to where a lot of times there's not truly, even though the buyer's representation agreement exists, it wasn't usually enforced to be used by a lot of brokerages because the commission was advertised on MLS. And so then when you write a contract, there's a, you know, page in the contract that states how much commission they're going to pay you. And it was just kind of one of those things that, you know, it was advertised, that you agreed on it. And, you know, for the most part in residential real estate, you know, the listing broker had an agreement as a co-brokerage of what they would pay you for bringing a buyer and what they would pay that representation to be. And so that's, you know, again, we've gotten used to that. It's been a very easy system, but now because of all these lawsuits, is now getting into more spelling it out and being specific and making sure that each buyer that you represent, you know, has an understanding of truly how things work and where money comes from. So it's just, you know, it's crossing T's and dotting I's, and that's what you should be doing in real estate, period. So
yeah,
it's all good. It's just going to be a learning curve and getting used to it and knowing how to present it and, you know, have the conversation with your buyer. But as Ash and I were talking offline, in a lot of cases, like, you know, we obviously specialize in investment real estate, And so a lot of times when you're, when we're sourcing deals that might be coming from an off market opportunity or a situation where the, you know, it's a wholesaler, you know, pitching the property, you know, they're not structuring it with a commission in there to, you know, as you representing your buyer or paying a commission to a buyer's agent to bring a deal. So if you want a commission, then you have to basically build it into the deal. You know, so if you're paying $100,000 for a property and you want 3%, then you basically, you have to present it to your investor and let the investor know up front that it's going to be structured that way. $100,000 deal is going to cost the investor 103% or $103,000 versus $100,000 because you're representing them to find the deal, find the opportunity, and therefore you're getting paid by providing that service, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just spelling that out. And most people don't have a problem with that, right? It's just like anything, any kind of service that you pay for in any other industry, you know, nobody has an issue with paying a service for good service, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just understanding the process, I believe.
Yeah. I think there'll just be a learning period and a friction point. And, you know, there might be some people that you say, look, this just isn't, that's not worth, this transaction is not worth it for me to what you're expecting to pay. That's fine, you know, but I know what I'm bringing to the table, and sticking to your guns on certain things of like, hey, I bring value in this area. And what we were talking about too is the ironic part is a lot of times on the investor side, there is more work because investors don't necessarily, they're not emotionally attached to an area. They just want a good deal and they want an investment to work. And so there's a lot of math involved, and let's figure out the, you know, the rents here, and okay, with this cash flow, yeah, you know, and you know, you're not making the decision for them, but you want to present the information to say, hey, I have to run it on my side just to be like, is this even something worth passing on? And so you're running a lot of deals, you're trying to find little nooks and crannies, and ironically, the buy price typically is lower because they're trying to buy cheaper houses to make rentals or whatever, and as opposed to, you know, selling a house to a family that might be, hey, their big thing is, well, what school district is this in? You know, what kind of bedrooms is, can we get gas run to the house? Is, you know, what's the tax rate? Those are a lot of the concerns there. But once you sort of answer some of those, it's not this rocket science type transaction, but usually it's worth a lot more because, you know, single family homes around here, average price is 440, and the actual towns we live in, it's much higher. So, yeah, it'll be cool to see how it goes, and everyone will have to find their lane. All I'm doing right now is learning as much as I can, learning the process, making contacts, just, you know, just working. So whenever it comes out on the other side, I'll have as much knowledge to offer someone else as I can. So speaking of rents, there was a report. Have you heard of the website called Zumper? Z-U-M-P-E-R, Zumper?
No, you just sent it to me, and I've never seen that before.
Well, it was in an article of Dallas Morning News, and they cited this website called Zumper as like this definitive how much rent should be website. I'm like, well, maybe. I don't know everything about everything, but it's really weird that I operate in this world pretty regularly, and I've never heard of the name Zumper. But they came out with a report, and they, I would have to look at it. It's probably about 20 suburbs in DFW. To say the average rents, are they up or down year over year? And basically across the board, they're down. You know, Irving is way down 13-14%. Again, we'll link this in the show notes. We'll put it out on social. But the only two in our area that are up at all, Carrollton's up 3%. And I believe Mesquite is up, oddly, 14-something%. And, you know, the explanation for this could be that apartments went through a huge growth phase for a while. They were really doing a lot of apartment starts, throwing up a lot of units, and maybe that's just catching up to them a little bit. I also kind of suspect that with inflation and high rents, there has got to be more co-living type situations, friends, you know, pitching in to rent a room. So maybe the overall demand is less because people are going to having to be more dense. I don't know that, you know, I don't see that specifically in this article, but I would have to think that that is part of it. You know, with Luke turning 18 soon, we had the conversation. You're like, hey, by the way, what is your plan? And he's like, I was going to live here. Is that fine? Like, it's fine. But I think 18-year-olds is one thing, but how far out do you get to where someone's just still living at home or living with someone else and they don't really have a need for an apartment? So seeing that big picture was a little eye-opening. to see that the rents are down some, but it'll be a push-pull because they'll slow down on their development. And I'm sure it's harder to pencil deals right now because of the interest rates anyway. And so here in 2 or 3 years, we'll be screaming because there's just not enough supply and, you know, rents are going up and everyone will be like, ah, let's get into the apartment game. So I'm sure it goes that way every once in a while. So, well, Tavis, why don't we shift gears a little bit and get into our conversation that we were talking about. I've been working with a lot of buyer clients on the investment side. So I'm affiliated with a website, Bigger Pockets. They have about 50,000 members, according to them. That's where I really cut my teeth on knowledge on the investment stuff, listening to their podcast. And I went to their conference a couple years ago. And, you know, it's a huge resource. And a lot of people go there to learn. Well, you can become a preferred agent now. You can pay for some leads. And so I pop up as a guy from Dallas that's investor friendly. And so people reach out to me. And so Aaron, Dr. Aaron that we were did the midterm rental for, that's where I was connected with him. And he's been a little bit of the exception. I've met 2 or 3 guys on there that are very sure about what they want. And they're experienced. You know, Aaron had a short term up in the Smokies, short term in the Broken Bow, and he knew exactly what he wanted to do here. But for the most part, it's these newbies. And I, you know, I'm definitely new in my journey. So there's no shame in being new and trying to learn. But one thing that is apparent is when you're new, it's so easy to get caught up in the analysis paralysis. And I didn't tell you this, Tavis, but I actually talked to a guy yesterday and I don't know what book he had read, but he called me and he said, here's what I'm looking for. And he was pretty brash about it. And he said, here's what I'm looking for. I need a quadplex. My budget's 350. I need a quadplex with commercial and an ADU. And I'm like, it's just like you picked out 3 real estate terms and said, let's just do them all, you know, mm-hmm. like a quadplex with commercial and an ADU, like additional dwelling unit. So I'm looking for some sort of quadplex with a little shopping center on the front and a garage apartment or a pool house for under $350,000. Like, okay, well, if I see that, I'll pass it along, but probably not, you know. But a lot of these guys, you know, they want long-term rents or they want midterm or whatever it is. And it's so easy just like, okay, just keep sending deals. Let's look at this. Let's look at this. And the orders of magnitude of difference between this little neighborhood and this little neighborhood actually is relatively small, but it seems so big when you're that on that front end of things and you want to make the right decision. So I know you were having this conversation yesterday with a friend of ours that's kind of on the, you know, looking to invest. So why don't you talk about some of the stuff that you and, you know, Matt Aycock, who's been on the podcast, y'all were helping Ryan out, and talk about some of the questions, kind of the basics that you want to consider early on when you're looking to invest.
Yeah. So the, and you know, it's funny. I hear myself say that. I think every time I start something, a sentence, I say, yeah, so
I edit some of it out.
I got to get better than that. I don't know why I have crutch words too.
Well, look, when I edit the podcast, I go back and I listen. I'm like, good grief. I say that a lot, you know? So I'll edit some of those out. If it becomes super repetitive, I edit them.
Yeah.
So the listener may not even know it, but yeah.
I just caught myself saying it. I'm like, oh man.
Oh yeah. We both have a lot of vocal crutches.
So there I go again. One of the things we were talking about was just basically like when you have an initial conversation with an investor is asking them, you know, do you see yourself being passive or do you see yourself being active? Right. And I think those are two really big, broad categories. But basically active means you're going to be in it day to day. It's going to basically become your job. Right. I think everybody's goal as an investor is to eventually build their portfolio to a point where it is passive and it becomes mailbox money, right? It becomes cash flow that's created after, you know, basically building these entities that, you know, require a little bit of time, and you can even leverage it further, right? By hiring management companies and all these things and really being hands off for the most part and just collecting a paycheck. Right. Ultimately, I think that's the idea of wealth building and building multiple streams of income that come from your investments. But not everybody's in a position to do that. And if you're trying to scale your business, it may require a lot more active duties in the beginning to grow it, right? Because anybody can go buy a rental essentially and cash flow $100 a month, $200 a month, like that. And technically, they have a cash flow model that's relatively passive. I mean, it depends if you're self-managing it or not, if you're talking just residential real estate. But, you know, if you're wanting to take that and multiply it, you know, it's going to create active presence, right? Whether you're doing, you mentioned it earlier about the BRRRR strategy, right? Which is, you know, buy, renovate, refinance, you know, repeat. You don't hear it a lot right now because interest rates are so high. So there's a lot of people that had that mindset of the BRRRR mentality have kind of pulled back. Now, it can still be done with an added value property, right? If it's a property that has a lot of equity in it, and you go in and do a major renovation and you get it stabilized, then you might be able to exercise that equity, pull that equity out, and then go and roll it into the next deal, right? And that's how you scale that business and continue to grow, depending on what kind of cash you're sitting on when you first start this side of the business. Otherwise, as we may know, you know, flipping, wholesaling, you know, wholesaling is what everyone talks about. You can get in with basically little money or, you know, a minimum amount of money, but it is very time consuming, right? So, you know, everybody talks about it and it kind of becomes this get rich quick concept, but it is, you know, it's very time intensive. There you go. Right. Cause you've got to build your buyers list. You've got to, you know, obviously find your sellers that are willing to buy or willing to sell the property. And that's going to require, you know, phone calls, it's require marketing. So it may not cost you a lot of money per deal, per se. Like, let's say that, you know, you're putting up earnest money, right? Earnest money might cost you a couple $1,000 and you're going to get that back, you know, with the transaction. But what you don't see and what we don't talk about and what they don't advertise is how much money you actually will spend and invest between your mailers or your VAs, yep, or, you know,
cold callers,
your research and your cold calling, your hours, your time, you know, those things that all go into it. And if you work a full-time W-2 job, you may not have the time or the availability to switch into that process, right? Mm-hmm. So then let's say, okay, well, let's go into flipping. You got some cash sitting there. Now you're looking for the deal. So that's why now a wholesaler is valuable to you to have a relationship with, because the wholesaler is putting together this package, right? And they found the deal, they sourced the deal, they put a big red ribbon around it. And yes, they're making a fee on the deal, but if the deal still makes sense for you, then you pull the trigger and you figure out how you're going to finance it, whether it's hard money, whether it's cash, whether it's bank, whether it's, you know, Ashton or a private money guy or whoever. And you take the deal down and then you renovate it. And of course, that's all comes to, you know, kind of what we talked about early on in our podcast. If you guys are listening now and just tuning in, go back and watch some of our early episodes, because we kind of dive into a series of flips and kind of talking about the strategies and the processes of how to flip a home, right? How to kind of build your team and what's important, and anything from the construction aspect to the numbers of the game to the real estate psychology behind it. You know, all of that is discussed early on in our podcast. So please go check that out. But on the other hand, that's more of an active role, right? So like talking about it with your, you know, with your buddy and going through that with Ryan, it's kind of like, you know, he's the kind of guy that likes to roll up his sleeves and get his hands dirty and be involved. But knowing what we know, you know, it just depends on, does he want to completely recreate the wheel and go off and build this and almost, you know, almost in a way, I mean, there's enough business out there, but does he want to do exactly the same thing that I'm doing with building up a team and running through it and flipping, you know, house one by one? Or does it make more sense for him to kind of, you know, team up, learn, kind of be a piece of it, be more of a money supplier, if you will, and get a return on that and kind of grow and then multiply as you can stack up those returns? You know, then you can go into bigger, better stuff, right? You can get into, you know, things that are going to allow you to climb the ladder of wealth building, you know, whether you're buying, you know, small multifamily, or whether you're buying commercial property, or whether you're getting into, you know, a car wash, for instance, you know, or other business models that make sense, that kick out mm-hmm. good amount of dividends, that may be, you know, hands-free, you know. So it's just learning those things, right? And yeah. and fortunately for me, you know, flipping has always kind of been a underlying basis. It's a job, right? That's how I make income annually. It's just like selling real estate or providing a service, you know, that we've talked about. And so you want to keep that going, because that's an annualized job that you're going to get income from. But the excess income that you make on and above what it costs you to live can then be invested into, you know, building wealth and buying, you know, 12-month rentals or midterm rentals or, you know, commercial property that I have now. And so, and then from that point, as these equities grow and, you know, the combination of my background with flipping, I was able to do that with a commercial building and do an added value type of purchase. And because it's commercial and because it's based on cap rate, the numbers have, you know, grown four times, you know, my investment. So 400% in a matter of 2 years is mm-hmm. what I've been able to, you know, potentially get out of that property. Yeah. And now the question becomes, now what? You know, yeah. do I hang on to it? Do I pay it off and just eat off of it, you know, eventually? Or do I take that and leverage that and scale it to now 1031 that equity and move into a bigger property or something more expensive that's going to kick out a different return, or a newer building? Yeah. And, you know, and so there's all those opportunities that grow. So it's not really a simple conversation, you know, and yeah. I think going back to what you're talking about, it really, you can spend a lot more time and effort, you know, working and facilitating an investor client. The benefit is that client should do multiple deals with you per year for many years going forward. So,
oh, absolutely. And plus I just enjoy it. You know, I like running the numbers. I'm doing it for myself. It's like solving a puzzle. It's challenging, you know, and so I really like it. The other thing that you got to consider is, do you want cash flow or do you want appreciation? You know, and in an ideal world, you'd have a ton of cash flow and a really up and coming place, you know, but a lot of times, a lot of cash flow typically means a little bit more of a risky investment, which means maybe a bad part of town, and it's going to be more work to try to keep that place up or fix it up, or you're going to have turnover in rents. Usually the nicer parts of town, you're paying more for that house and the rents don't keep up with that. And so you're making less cash flow, but it's a nicer house. The basis was probably a little bit more, $300,000 or $400,000. So you're going to get to ride that appreciation. So if you can break even and, you know, just kind of ride appreciation for a while, and then maybe rents catch up year 3, 4, 5, 6, now you are cash flowing some. I have several people that's kind of what they're wanting to do, because they have good W-2s. You know, you flip for money. I'm trying to get into the flipping for money and doing the retail job stuff. But they have a great job as an engineer or doctor, whatever it is. They don't really have any desire. They don't really need an extra $200 a month in cash flow or $300 right. a month. They want to just, like, why don't we get a really safe, easy, maybe even a new build, or like a lot of them, I'm actually looking for 2000 and a newer. So we're looking for 300 and less by price, 4-bedroom plus. That gives us this nice little window of low buy price, but higher rents and newer than 2000, you know, because we're talking about anything older than 1985, your cast iron, your capital expenditures, all that stuff is going to be higher. So that's kind of the little window we've been looking for, because I have a good job. I don't really need the cash flow. I just want a safe thing that I can put it in here. It's going to raise with the appreciation. They're going to pay my mortgage off. You're going to get the depreciation benefits of owning the house too. So, So do you need the cash flow or not? Yeah. I really need cash flow. Okay. Well, you're probably going to be doing some cheaper houses in, you know, parts of Dallas and Fort Worth and maybe Abilene that can really get you some cash flow. Or if it's this other side, let's go. And then ideally there's a blend, you know, that's where your garlands and your mesquites and the colony, that's kind of like, okay, I can get a little bit cash flow, decent appreciation. You know, that's kind of like a hybrid, Arlington, that sort of thing. So,
And you're talking long-term or 12-month rental, right?
Yeah. Long-term. Yeah, long-term rental. Because if you get into the midterms, now your upfront cost is more. You're going to have to furnish it. You're going to have to, you know, have some sort of management, either pay a manager or you're going to have to do some self-managing. Then you go even further to the short-term Airbnb stuff. Really hands-on. But then on that side, there's some different tax benefits. So there's all these conversations. And so I don't know that I'm simplifying it by saying this now, but all of this to say is I learned the most when I just did something. Mm-hmm. And I looked back and said, okay, I would do it differently this time. And like even the rental, the rent house over in Sweetwater, you know, I'm learning a ton. Am I getting rich off of that? No, but I'm learning a ton. How would I do it this next time? What am I going to look for? How would I structure my lease? How do I deal with a tenant? Like I should be more strict here. Like you're learning a ton. And I would get none of those benefits if I just kept running the numbers. And what if we did it here? And what about this? Like looking for that unicorn property, the quadplex commercial with an ADU. If you just wait around for this unicorn type deal to happen, it probably is going to take a long time. So my tip is pick a lane, maybe pick a mentor or two that's done that, and then say, look, and then set a deadline. Say, I'm going to find the very best thing. I'm going to buy something by April, June, whatever. I'm going to find the very best thing that I can find before then, and then I'm going to pull the trigger, and we're going to go from there. And I guarantee deal number two, you'll find faster because you will be able to identify what's good or bad. And there's only so much you can learn by listening to podcasts and reading books and all that sort of thing. So this long conversation of all the nuances of how you can get into it is all to say it doesn't necessarily matter. You know, pick one, become proficient. Maybe you pivot a little bit. But 1 or 2 years on the front side of your investing journey is not going to make or break you. You're going to build, but you have to start building somewhere. And I think if you wait one more year, I mean, I went 20 years between when I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and when I bought my first flip. Probably not advisable. You know, I missed out on a lot of education in there. And was I smart enough to try to figure it out in the meantime? Sure, I could have done it, you know, but I didn't. And I regret that part. But, you know, now I'm in it and now I'm learning. So I would say,
it goes back to we've mentioned this before, right? And I think, you know, the whole point of this is you're basically saying, how does my money make money? Right.
Yeah.
And then you just have to decide on where that direction is going to go. You know, that makes sense for you, you know, and for your lifestyle. Like you said, these doctors and stuff that have great businesses, you know, where's their excess cash flow going? And how does that get invested? And what do they want to learn? And what do they want to explore? You know, like your one client that has, you know, properties in, you know, Smoke in Tennessee and Broken Bow and all of that. He's already kind of started doing that, right? His excess money that he makes on and above what he needs to live off of is being invested and used as a tool. And then he gets excited about it and he's trying something new and, you know, it's something that, you know, and I know he's listening, so shout out to you. But, you know, it was the thing, it's funny he brought up because we were kind of talking about it saying, man, I don't know, you know, he's doing this deal in Candy Creek and, you know, we were trying to get him a better deal on it, but he wanted to do it, you know, and so he's just like told me the other day, he's like, man, just wait and see. I know you were saying it, but I'm going to prove you wrong. It's going to do great.
I think it will do great. It actually appraised for way more than I thought it was going to appraise for.
I think it's going to be good. And we're in the middle of the design phase of it right now. And it's coming together pretty good.
What's ironic about this whole conversation is he's one of our investors and he's like, dude, just pull the trigger. We were sitting there and analyzing it. Like,
I know,
we can get
right?
this for a better deal. Let's find another house. Like, let's look at. He's like, no, we're doing this one. And there you go. I mean, he's comfortable with his lane. He knows what he wants to do. And we're sitting there being like, okay, what if we did that? Like, so no one's immune from it, but he only knows that because he's done so much research and he's actually gotten in the game and done some short term and he's met other mentors and he's in part of some masterminds to say like, no, this is a good deal. You know,
he's vetted his exit strategies. And I think that's a part that if you're going to analyze anything, analyze your exit strategies. If you get into the deal and you don't want it anymore, or it doesn't make sense, how do you get out of it? And I think that's something that I'm always going into it. And when I have conversations with my bank, when they're financing a deal, I have multiple exit strategies, right?
Yeah.
It's like, there's more ways to make money than just one avenue on an opportunity of what I'm buying. And so I think the bank loves that. You know, it's risk adverse in that sense. And sure. It may not make the most sense. Maybe I have a lane that I wanted to go in, like my midterm rentals. That's the highest and best use, in my opinion. But if something happens and it's not producing, what are my other options? Yeah. You know, I can go 12 month. I can still make, you know, money in the green on the 12 month rental, even though it's not as sexy. It's not as attractive. Or mm-hmm. I can sell it and make an equity because I bought these with the added value concept. And I bought them in a margin that made sense to flip them. And then really the excess in it, you know, the first year is obviously buying all the furniture. That doesn't make sense to flip, right? You're not going to do that on a typical flip. So that eats up a bunch of the margin. So if you have it long enough, though, that cash flow pays off the furniture, then, you know, you're back in the green again from a flip model, right? So it's just really understanding those pieces.
Your exit strategies and all that.
Yeah. And I mean, again, over the years that I've been doing this now and being exposed to different things, you know, just like the conversation last night, you know, you can put money in a CD and make 5%. You can obviously, I'm not a big stock guy because it's never been my lane. It's not what I know. I invest in what I know, which is real estate. But another piece of the real estate avenue is then like putting your money with a successful hard money lender. And a hard money lender is borrowing other people's money, you know, paying a return on that, and then they're making the yield. So let's say that they pay an investor 8% on their money and they're charging the borrower 12%, you know, hypothetically, they're making a 4% gross yield. Obviously, they have servicing and they have a lot of other soft costs that are involved in that as a lender. So they're not making the full amount, but they're making a yield. And that's something you can do. That's, again, is it super sexy? Is it something you can go touch, smell, and feel? No, but you're making a good return that's higher than what you're going to make in the bank, right?
Yeah.
And again, you could be a lender yourself. You could do a private money lending deal, depending on it. And you might be able to get those numbers into double digits, you know, for doing something like that, like you've done with your friends and, you know, doing with another colleague now, you know, and those kind of things. And you can kind of step your way up into that too. And they can learn. And it's a safer way for them as long as you're aligned with the right people. And, you know, you make sure that you're investing with people that know what they're doing and has a track record and you check their references and things like that, right? That's always important because obviously there's a lot of scam artists and a lot of bad people out there too that will take money if you give them money and they'll take it and run. We talked about that last week with the builder facing prison time.
From last week for the 99-year prison term. So, and actually he was dwarfed in other news. I don't really fancy knowing much about the Philippine real estate market, but there is a Filipino developer, also member of the government, that is facing the death penalty she figured out how to embezzle $12.5 billion along with several other people. So yes, there's orders of magnitude of scams, but always know where you're putting your money. Well, I hope you enjoy that conversation. You know, I know we have a lot of newer investors listening. Hopefully that didn't confuse it more. But just know you've got a lot of options, but one of the best things you can do is just take the leap, surround yourself with smart people, and you're smart as well. Trust yourself and go for it. And at the end of the day, if you need to go deliver pizzas to make up some losses, you can do that too. We really appreciate you tuning in. I am Ashton Hines, Dallas Real Estate Guy on Instagram. I actually might be DallasRealEstateGuy.com on my website that I'm trying to revamp because my old website went away and is into the ether. So I'm working on that. Tavis Westbrook, Tavis Westbrook Designs. That's Travis without the R. You can find him all over Instagram and Facebook. And he's actively working on some plans. And I know he really enjoys that part. So if you need some design work, some blueprints, anything like that, Tavis is great at that. We're always looking for deals. So if you're a realtor out there and you have someone that you need to connect with us in order to get their house sold, it's not appropriate for the MLS, we'd love to talk to you. If you're an investor and you have some questions, you want to sit down for some coffee, if you're local, we'd love to do that too. So please reach out, send us a message. and we will connect with you. Until then, thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.